When you think about food from the outdoors, you likely think about your garden. But there's a whole garden out there that you didn't plant, and you can harvest it if you know what and when to forage. Larry Mueller here, and great to have Sam Thayer with us today. Sam's a lifelong forager and the author of a couple of books. One's titled The Forager's Harvest. The other is titled Nature's Garden. He's an all-around naturalist and has a passion for wild food. It extends to studying the origin of cultivated plants and even the socioeconomic history of the human diet. And Sam, it is great to have you back with us. Thank you so much for joining us here on the Ideas Network.
Well, I'm honored to be here, Larry.
Always great to have you come by. Your book, and by the way, I want to give our listeners a chance to join in. Questions about foraging, and we have some already. Ray and Rhinelander, we'll get to you in a minute or two. But you can join in, too, with your own questions or comments or maybe your experiences to share in foraging. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Really love to hear from you, so give us a call or go online or go to our Facebook page, and we're glad to take your questions. Are you out foraging these days?
In fact, I just was this morning. I have a week-long foraging class right now, and right now they're cutting up some vegetables we collected this morning and listening on the radio. In the summer, I'm collecting something pretty much every day.
That is very, very cool. As a matter of fact, which book was? Oh, Nature's Garden. It has a great calendar for when food is at its peak for foraging, or still present but declining. And just right now, what is best in this time of the year?
You know, foraging is fun because, like gardening, it's really seasonal, and so you've got to be on the spot to get things when they're ready, and every time of year, different things are ready, and right now, it's the time for berries. It's the time for what I call hot weather annual greens. Some of the greens that are coming into their prime right now are amaranth, lamb's quarters, purslane, black mustard. Those are real common weedy greens that almost everyone has access to. And the berries, service berries are getting ripe. Mulberries are just past their peak, but still good. Red raspberries are just hitting their peak. Black raspberries just passing their peak. Blueberries are ripe. We don't have the fantastic crop we had last year, but there's still some out there. So it's a time for berries and greens right now, primarily.
Ray and Rhinelander, thanks a lot for calling. What's on your mind?
Thanks. Thanks, Larry, for having this person on. This is just such fun and amazing. Is this Samuel Thayer I'm talking to?
Yes.
Okay, I have your Nature's Garden Edible Wild Plants book. It's fantastic. I mean, the way this is presented with the different pictures and explanations, it really helps me out a lot. I have two questions. One is, I live around Rhinelander, Wisconsin, obviously. Do you ever come up here and do anything for classes, or where's the closest you get nearby? And there's some copycat plants up here that look very similar that can be dangerous if you eat them. Do you know any of those? And any other advice you can give me on furthering this, because I'm really into this.
Okay. Well, I'm glad that you found the book useful. That's what I was hoping. Now, as far as copycat plants, I'll take the questions in reverse order. I've actually never heard that term before, but there are confusing plants that look similar to other plants. Now, some plants really are quite unmistakable, and some may have a confusing relative or even a poisonous plant that looks somewhat similar. And my best advice to anybody is to learn your plants one at a time. Don't think you're going to learn foraging. Just learn one plant. Carefully identify it with a couple of books. Go out and find it several times to make sure you're absolutely confident of your identification. And when you really know that plant, it will start to look very distinct. So, you know, you maybe have, I don't know if you're married, if you say you have a wife, and you, somebody might look sort of like her to a stranger, but to you, nobody looks like her. It's the same thing with plants. When you become really familiar with them, they look distinct. But you have to take that time to identify them properly and one at a time. And there is no plant that has a look-alike that cannot be told apart or that you need to be an expert to tell apart. There's no situation like that out there. So if you're being reasonably careful in identifying your plants, you will be able to tell them apart.
Now, what about your classes, and do you ever stray to the Rhinelander area?
You know, I do anywhere from like 8 to 20 different programs a year. Some I have a few longer classes and some shorter workshops. I have done classes in the Rhinelander area in the past. I don't have any scheduled right now. I guess later this month I have something at the Mole Lake Reservation. I don't know if that's open to the public in general or just tribal members. I do a number of public programs every year, and I usually post those on my website so people can see where I'm coming. But I tell you that I can only teach you a few plants in a two-hour workshop or a three-hour walk. But if you take the time, this is a lifelong experience, and you can learn two plants one summer, and you do that for a few years, all of a sudden you have a pretty good repertoire of wild edibles you know.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So there you go, Ray. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. We'll get Rob and Madison on board here next. Hi, Rob.
Hi there. Sam, I got your book in my hands at this very moment, Nature's Garden. And I've been reading a lot of it lately. And I just want you to go into a little bit of detail about some of the plants that are so common along the roadsides, like Queen Anne's Lace, cow parsnip, the wild parsnip. They're everywhere. And I'm just wondering if you could just talk about them for a few minutes and tell me which parts of those plants and tell the audience which parts are edible. Then I'll hang up.
All right. Thank you for calling.
Sure. Well, my first thought about roadside plants is that in the last decade or so, people have become very, very Roundup happy. And things are sprayed more often than they're mowed, and that's something to keep an eye out for wherever you're foraging. But these common roadside or weedy plants, I call them meadow plants, plants that like sunny areas, but they're not necessarily in a place that's recently disturbed, an abandoned farm field or a meadow. Collecting them there gets you off of the roadside where there might be some other dangers. There's a lot of really good edibles, and you did mention three of the common ones, parsnip, cow parsnip, and Queen Anne's Lace, which is wild carrot. Gosh, I don't like to work with a whole list of plants, you can eat of the parsnip and the wild carrot. You can eat the root, and you can also eat the tender young stalk. However, the wild parsnip, which is the same as the cultivated parsnip, either cultivated or wild parsnips can cause a severe rash if you get the juice on your skin. Now, when you're digging up parsnip roots in the fall, that's not really an issue. But you don't get a rash from just touching the plant, but you can get a severe rash from the juice on your skin. So that's something to be concerned about. I've gotten the rash before when I was swimming or running around, never actually when I was harvesting parsnips. Now, cow parsnip is a native plant that is enormous and beautiful, the stalks of that are peeled and traditionally eaten by Native Americans all over North America, and also it's a very popular vegetable in Europe. The time for that, those stalks, has really passed. But there's a whole bunch of really good plants that would grow in meadows and roadsides.
Thanks very much for that call. Appreciate it. We had a nice call from Rhinelander, another nice caller from Rhinelander, who learned in a mushroom foraging class presented by Larry Monthy. You may have known him, Sam. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
It's about 30 years ago, and the comment is when you know them, the things that you're foraging for, you know them. It's like finding the face of a friend in the crowd.
Exactly. And I tell people, you use the banana test. I mean, you never pick up a banana and think, is this really a banana? You know it's a banana, right? You know when it's a raspberry. So when you're that confident about any plant, that's when you're ready to eat it.
Sam Thayer, our guest today, talking with him about midsummer foraging. He is a lifelong forager, author of The Forager's Harvest and Nature's Garden. You can join in with your questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page and you can post your question or your comment there. We'd certainly love to hear from you. But these classes, by the way, they must be a lot of fun.
Well, I think it's a lot of fun. And I think the people that come to classes think it's a lot of fun. it's mind-boggling sometimes how many things there are to eat. And it's exciting to try these flavors that you can't get anywhere else. And sometimes, you know, people think of foraging as a survival thing. And it would be a great skill to have if you were ever stuck in a situation where you desperately needed food. But I teach people foraging as something to do because it's fun and because the food is really good, and it's unique food you can't get anywhere else. An example that's available right now to everybody in the state, rural or urban, north to south, is evening primrose flowers.
Hmm.
Now, I'm going to tell you a little secret, that if you get an evening primrose flower just as it closes up, because they only open for one day, so the day after it was open, they've got a long tube at the base of the flower, and you pull that off the day after they bloom, it tastes a little bit like Captain Crunch. there's this sweetness in the tube of that flower. But the flower is just a great vegetable you can throw in a stir fry, you can throw in a soup, you can put them on a salad. It's pretty, it's delicious, and you can't buy it anywhere. If you like food, go out and try this.
Now, what about the berries? That's a great tip. What about the berries? They're so delicious. And they're, you know, kind of pricey in the stores. So talk about the berries you can find now foraging.
Sure. I mean, berry picking is our favorite family pastime. Last weekend, we went picking mulberries and black raspberries, two excellent berries that are available. Well, both of them are more in the southern half or southern two-thirds of the state. But great summer berries. I just have all wonderful memories of picking both as a child. They both make great jam and great jelly and juice, or we mix them with apple puree to make fruit leather, or we just stuff our faces when we're out there picking. We have two mulberries, our native red mulberry, which is quite rare, and then we have the invasive white mulberry from Europe, but both of them have this blackberry-like fruit, and it's easy to identify. It's a tree with a blackberry-like fruit. There's nothing you can confuse with a mulberry. Now in the northern part of the state, the blueberries are starting to come on, and the red raspberries. We've got a pretty good crop of red raspberries this year. Last year was a once-in-a-generation experience for blueberry pickers, and we're seeing just a fraction of the number of blueberries we had last year, but they're about at peak ripeness now or shortly. And some other things that aren't as well known but are really good, service berries or June berries.
Mm.
Last week I found a loaded tree, and I ate to my heart's content. they vary quite a bit from tree to tree, but if you find one good loaded tree that the birds haven't hit yet and pulled everything ripe off of, they're probably my favorite wild berry.
Oh, they are good. They really are good. Keith in Black River Falls has a question. Hi, Keith. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Several years ago, my wife and I gave a wilderness survival course, a presentation for a 4-H summer camp. And she did a segment on foraging, and it was such a hit that they have invited her back to give a presentation strictly on foraging. The problem runs in that the presentation, and we want some hands-on activities with this presentation, is going to be taking place in mid-August, and we're kind of struggling to figure out what plants we can show the kids at that time of the year. I'm just wondering if there are any recommendations on things that might be forage candidates during mid-August.
And where would that be at, Keith?
It's in Jackson County,
Black
River Falls area.
Yeah, so now you've got a lot of black huckleberry in Jackson County. And the black huckleberry, like a blueberry, the bush tends to be taller. The berry tends to be smaller, but I actually like them better. And they've got a crunchy seed. They peak in the first half of August. I don't know how good the crop is in your area this year. Haven't checked that out. Choke cherries will be getting ripe at that time. Pin cherries will be past their peak. There may be some left. And then also, a lot of people think of hazelnuts as ripening later than they actually do, but once you get the middle of August, that is time to go get your, especially the American hazelnut, which is so common in Jackson County. And I don't know about your area, but here in northwestern Wisconsin, we have a moderate to very good crop, depending on where I've looked at the hazelnuts this year. So that's something that you know, people will say, you got to get the hazelnuts before the squirrels get them. I can't get them before the squirrels get them. Well, I say, you go out a little earlier than you think they're ripe. Don't look at the husk. Don't wait for the husk to turn brown. Peel the husk back and look at the nut. If the nut is turning brown, that nut is ripe. And so if you're in the middle of August or later, you should be able to find ripe hazelnuts.
All right.
Yeah. Very good. Thanks so much for the information. Where could we find access to that calendar that kind of listed the different things and when they become?
Oh, in Sam's book. It's in Sam's book, Nature's Garden.
Okay. Yeah, actually, both books have a calendar for the plants that are in there, referencing when they would be available.
Yeah.
Great.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. I appreciate your call. And Sam, by the way, what's your website?
The website is foragersharvest.com.
Foragersharvest.com. That's the place to go. Sam Thayer, our guest today, author of that book and also the book Nature's Garden. I'm Larry Mueller, Brandy Funker, on-air producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking midsummer foraging with Sam Thayer, author of The Forager's Harvest and Nature's Garden. And again, you can join in 800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org. Let's go to Daniel in Minong next. Daniel, hi, thank you for calling.
Hello. Back in the early 70s, I had a sore throat when I awoke, quite a sore throat. And in my studies, I had read that the Native Americans, for survival rations, had stripped the cambrium layer of bark of white pines, which I thought was a probably hideous thought to eat that turpentine-like taste. But when I was out, we had been gathering wood, and there was a piece of exposed of the cambrium layer of a white pine. So I cut off a little bit of it and ate it just partly for the taste and experience. But that resin coated my throat, so it didn't hurt when I swallowed, and it also never came back, the sore throat.
Huh. Wow.
That's an interesting story. I have not ever used white pine for that. However, the use of pine bark as a food is historically very widespread. Native Americans throughout North America did that, but the Sami people in northern Scandinavia also did that with Scotch pine, and they would store large amounts of pine bark traditionally. They would actually hang it from the trees, and then they would use it if they needed it. The flavor is not nearly as bad and as piney as it sounds. The key part is to get the very inner bark, which has very little resin in it, just a faint piney flavor. And sometimes, and I don't experiment with it often, because generally if I see a wind-fallen pine, I might experiment. I don't ever cut down a pine to do this. But I've had pine inner bark that was delicious and very sweet. So I don't know always why it gets so sweet, but sometimes it's extremely sweet.
That is very interesting. And there are other plants that certainly have medicinal values, are there not?
Yes, and I don't specialize in medicinal plants, and that's a very complex topic in and of itself. But a lot of these wild plants have traditional medicinal uses, and some of them are perfectly safe and reasonable to try on your own, like pine bark. And some of them are still used commercially, like slippery elm bark. You can still buy slippery elm lozenges for sore throats. However, I find that if you peel your own slippery elm bark, it works much better than the lozenges that you can buy. And the flavor is delicious. I like the slippery, take the inner bark of slippery elm, boil it until the water starts to get a little thick and mucilaginous. I sweeten it a little bit with maple syrup, and it's delicious, and it soothes a sore throat. So a lot of them are very practical to use.
There you go. Ryan and Brilliant, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Great, appreciate your call. What's on your mind?
Sure. Well, first I want to say hi to Sam. Actually, Sam, I'm a good friend of your wife's family, and I met you at a wedding, at BJ and Danielle's wedding. But I wanted to make a comment about your books. We love your books, and we I thought it would be interesting to talk about milkweed. A lot of people think that milkweed is poisonous, and we learned from Sam that it is not, and actually it's delicious. We pick it all the time with our kids and eat it just as it is and put it in salads and things like that. And I thought it might be interesting to talk about monarchs and milkweed.
You know, that's something that I'm really interested in. In fact, with my class yesterday, we collected milkweed flower buds. We boiled them and drained the water and ate them. Now, milkweed, it's a little bit of a tricky topic because there are about 10 species native to Wisconsin, and only two of those are considered edible. That's the common milkweed, what most of us think of as milkweed, and then poke milkweed, which is not to be confused with pokeweed. Now, I recommend people to cook any parts of milkweed. Some people eat milkweed parts raw, but it does get some people an upset stomach when eaten raw. Milkweed was eaten basically universally by Native Americans in the eastern two-thirds of the continent, it is a well-known vegetable. But when it's in its shoot stage, it's sometimes confused with common dogbane, which also has milky sap. And the dogbane is extremely bitter, it's mildly poisonous, and that's where some of the myths with milkweed have come in. And the other species of milkweed, say we have swamp milkweed, we have world milkweed, a number of native milkweeds. We have purple milkweed, which is a beautiful native and endangered wildflower. These are not to be harvested. They are not edible. They generally have a high concentration of the same toxins that are in common milkweed at low concentrations. Last year, somebody got kind of upset with me for talking about eating milkweed because, you know, the monarchs are in peril and the monarchs need milkweed. And my response was, the monarchs do need milkweed. And what they need is a couple thousand people in the Corn Belt, like me, who eat milkweed and maintain a milkweed garden. Foraging and nature are not antithetical. We're not destroying nature when we eat it. This is a very sustainable thing when done responsibly. I have not only some very beautiful patches of milkweed that I maintain on my property, but I have been teaching people how to manage for milkweed, easy ways to get it to predominate in a pasture or a field, because I love milkweed because I eat it. But the monarchs benefit, and I benefit. We benefit together, and so I think it's a situation. It's a great teaching moment for how foragers can be responsible stewards of the land and not competing with wildlife, but helping wildlife.
Very good points. Ryan, thanks again for calling. I appreciate it. Rachel in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Hey, Sam. How you doing?
Hi, Rachel.
I've got a couple questions for you. I wanted to know if you have another book coming out soon first.
Well, coming out, but I don't know how soon. I try to do things the right way, and sometimes it takes a while.
So you are planning another one, though?
Yes.
Sweet. I also wanted to ask about online groups, Facebook groups, because I know there are a couple. Could you mention them?
You know, I'm not on Facebook, and I'm not part of any online groups, so I'm not that familiar, but I do know there's a Midwest Wild Edibles and Foragers group, and I don't even know if that's a Facebook or a Yahoo group because I'm not on it, but I hear a lot of talk about that group. And then there's a broader national group, this kind of two popular social media foraging groups that I hear about. You know, there's a lot of good information being passed back and forth, but there's also a lot of banter. So I do more of my research in the field or through books and in libraries or online, you know, research papers. I don't spend much time in those groups.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it just seems that, you know, for research, absolutely, you want to have something better, but it's great for networking and community building.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, and then I did have one last question. Are you coming to Southern Michigan anytime soon?
I don't have any teaching engagements planned in Southern Michigan this year. I probably will next year.
Oh.
I had a couple of ideas that I've been kind of toying around with or working on. So two people in my class actually this week are from Southern Michigan, and we've been kind of talking about that. So my family heritage is in Southern Michigan, and I love to come back. So I'm hoping next year to have some program going on in Southern Michigan.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Rachel. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Open lines will get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. Again, you can email us at talk@WPR.org or post on our Facebook page. Go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. You can post your questions, comments, or photos there. We'd certainly love to see those as well. We had an email from Gail in Milwaukee, and she has something about who should not forage. And the comment is, those who take their dogs into pristine places with garlic mustard stuck to their paws are those who can't identify the plants to be picked and destroy the tiny ecosystems in sensitive places. And those who forage for plants at the wrong time of the year, and those who expect to be able to forage enough to sell and make money.
You know, I agree with all of those statements. Foragers need to forage responsibly, just as fishermen need to fish responsibly and hunters need to hunt responsibly. And there are always some irresponsible people in any group. I told my group this morning, in fact, I said, I don't just want to teach you about edible wild plants. I want to teach you to be a responsible forager. I started volunteering for the Nature Conservancy when I was 16 years old. I'm very much into conservation and nature and always have been and always will be. And I see foraging not as something antithetical to that, but when practiced reasonably and responsibly, as foraging is a pathway to appreciating nature. We don't save what we don't know and what we don't love. When you have a plant that you forage for, you pay more attention to that plant than anyone else does. You sort of fall in love with that plant. You become a little bit enamored with it. And you will bend over backwards to preserve that. Just like it's Duck Hunters in Ducks Unlimited that has preserved thousands and thousands of acres of wetlands, foragers are the same way. And I could list numerous examples where the people collecting a plant are the ones who have made sure that that plant's conservation was guaranteed or have done everything they could to conserve that plant. On the other hand, there are irresponsible commercial foragers collecting a number of things and selling them. Primarily in this region, it's wild leeks or ramps. They are almost always harvested irresponsibly when they're harvested commercially. And it's really important for foragers as a group to be responsible, to teach responsible foraging, and to make it understood among their peers that's frowned upon. I mean, that irresponsible foraging is frowned upon. So I agree with everything that was written in there.
And sort of another comment to kind of go along with it, from talking about responsibilities. One caller said foragers need to make sure they have permission from the landowners before going out to pick. And maybe you can talk about this whole, the official and unofficial rules for foraging on public land or on private land.
Yeah, I mean, and again, it's like with anything else, you know, you need to respect private property and other people's property, and also the laws regulating the area that you're foraging. You know, I have my own property where I can forage for anything I want without worrying about what other people think. And a lot of people, particularly a lot of these plants we forage for are weedy plants. It's very easy to get permission to pick weedy plants. I'm taking my group to an organic farm this afternoon, and we are going to pick a bunch of weeds to our delight and the farmer's delight. It was very easy for me to get permission to do that. Now, in Wisconsin state parks, for example, you're allowed to pick edible nuts and berries and mushrooms for your own personal consumption. That's very reasonable. That's the same in Minnesota. I believe it's the same in Michigan. So, wherever you're foraging, you need to know what the rules and regulations are for doing that. But it's certainly the rules that exist now do not make foraging difficult to do. It's very easy to comply with those rules.
Scott in West Allis up next. Hi, Scott. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Good morning, Larry and Sam. I have a question for you is regarding cattails. I know they're edible, and I'm wondering if there's a specific time that they're better tasting than others, and if the younger ones are better than the older ones, and if any kind of licensing is required to be able to harvest them.
I don't know of any licensing requirements for harvesting cattails or any other wild edible plants other than ginseng and wild rice. As far as the parts and the way and the time in which they're harvested, there's something edible on a cattail at all times of year, but it changes fairly drastically. So right now, the part that you would eat on a cattail is the sideways growing shoot of the rhizome. So in the mud, under the water where that cattail is growing, the cattail has a thick, probably inch-thick rhizome, which is a sideways growing stem. And at the tip of that, it is white, almost like a giant fang, like a white dagger. And that is not only tender, it is delicious. It is one of the best vegetables you will ever try. But you have to know how to get it out of the muck. They're so tender that they're very brittle. It's hard to get them out without breaking them. And they're anywhere from 2 inches to 14 inches long. That's what's available right now. Earlier in the summer, it would have been the pollen, and before that, it would have been the flower buds or the spikes that later produce the pollen, and then before that, it would be the base of the cattail plant, the cluster of leaves at the very base, which are kind of white and soft, kind of like the interior of a leek, of a domestic leek, and then during the dormant season, this rhizome underground or underwater, under muck, is storing starch, and that starch is very edible. Cattail is a plant that is almost devoid of any toxic material because it competes by producing lots and lots of biomass, and it doesn't really have the spare energy to produce a toxin. And so it just produces massive amounts of biomass, and all of that biomass is essentially toxin-free. You just need to find the tender part.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Scott, for calling. Appreciate your call. As you were talking about the different seasons, I was thinking to myself, does he do any, is there foraging possible in the winter?
You know, Larry, there's just a little bit to forage in the winter. There are some things like twig and needle teas, spicebush tea, that's very limited in Wisconsin where it grows. You could collect Labrador tea in the winter and make pine needle tea. And then, of course, a few things can be collected, like the slippery elm bark, for example. But mostly, winter is the time to make stuff from all the stuff you collected in the fall. And we get lots of nuts, and we collect amaranth seeds and lamb's quarter seeds, and we have all the stuff to process and see what we can concoct and cook out of it throughout the winter. And I'm just as busy with wild food in the winter as I am in the summer. I'm just not collecting it. I'm seeing what I can cook out of it.
Oh, that's wonderful. Anne in Green Bay has something for us. Anne, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hello. Hey, Sam. I'm just wondering if there's any kind of movement afoot by the foragers to stop manicuring ditches. You know, the counties come along and cut all these wildflowers and parsnips and all that, and they spray all this stuff. And, you know, not only is that limiting foraging for us, but it's also creating a huge problem for the honeybees and the butterflies. And so I'm wondering if there's any kind of a national movement afloat to put an end to this manicuring.
You know, I don't know if there's a national movement, but there's certainly a movement in my house. I mean, I agree with you absolutely. And the most similar, I guess, the national movement I know of is for monarch preservation. This, what I called, you know, Roundup Trigger Happy, well, this is affecting monarchs dramatically, but it's affecting all kinds of other plants. The milkweed and the monarchs are just a flagship for a kind of a small-scale or a widespread, spread-out environmental disaster. I mean, vegetation is being sprayed for no reason. It's like because we have this bottle and we have the sprayer and we feel like spraying stuff. And it creates a health hazard for foragers, but it also just, it is habitat for doves and habitat for cottontails and habitat for, you know, insects. It's, everything is affected by it. I agree with you very much, but I don't know of any organized movement to stop that. I mean, I'm really happy, like, our township, they mow instead of spray. I feel like mowing is a pretty good compromise because you cut the vegetation down, but at least you don't poison it and kill it permanently.
Yeah, well, I'm just wondering if there's anything that you know, I don't know if you promote this when you're doing your classes to get people to maybe write legislators or town boards or whatever to maybe put an end to that. So
yeah. I definitely mention it, and you should keep mentioning it too. I don't know of any organized movement for that, but there should be.
Ann, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call very much. Let's see, a caller from Pulaski wondered if when you can pick juniper berries.
Juniper berries is more of a fall thing, and you know, and again, it's more of a seasoning, not really a food, but you know, it's perfectly fine to use as a seasoning.
I'm sure there are a lot of listeners wondering how you keep track. What are your tricks for marking or sort of remembering locations?
You know, I have this DeLorme Wisconsin Atlas and Gazetteer, and it's marked up with all kinds of things in the margins.
Ah.
I also keep a journal of every now and then I'll write down a spot and all the stuff I saw there. And I remember a lot of stuff off the top of my head. And I also remember by association. So if I see a certain flower, I might know that I probably am going to find six or seven other things because they grow together as a general rule. That really helps me keep track of where I find different wild foods.
And when you're out foraging, what do you have tools or supplies? What do you have for tools or supplies that you'd like to have with you?
Well, if I'm berry picking, I like my blicky, a little basket that wraps around. You know, I have the rope that I tie behind me, and it's a one-gallon container that sits on my belly. It helps me pick easily. I have a little scissors for clipping greens. And if I'm something that I dig, I have a shovel. I'm an equipment minimalist. That's about all the equipment that I use for foraging, unless it's something specialized, like, you know, harvesting wild rice. But don't have a whole lot of equipment.
And somebody else wondered if there are any plants you forage for their seeds.
Well, I did. I mentioned lamb's quarters and amaranth, both of which have a good edible grain. There's actually quite a few others. Jewelweed seeds taste like walnuts, and then there's some of the mustards. For instance, the black mustard I mentioned earlier. I mean, it's grown commercially for, you know, Dijon mustard, but it has these massive plants. I mean, they grow 6 to 9 feet tall, and they're loaded with seeds. If you want to make your own mustard, you can go collect mustard seeds and make it from scratch. There's a whole bunch of different plants that produce edible seeds.
Sam, it is always a real treat to be able to visit with you. I thank you so much. Again, where's your website? What's your website title? I think we have it up on our Facebook page, but what's the title?
Foragersharvest.com.
Foragersharvest.com. And Sam, I hope we have a chance to visit again soon. Thank you again.
Thank you so much, Larry.
And if you want to take a look at his books, his book titles, The Forager's Harvest, and then the more recent one is Nature's Garden, both by Sam Thayer. And I'm sure if you go to his website, foragersharvest.com, you're going to be able to order them right off his site. But you, of course, can also go to your local bookstore, and if they don't have it, they can get copies for you. Always a lot of fun to talk with him. Many of us are going to kind of continue talking about food here. Many of us are fortunate enough to have access to fresh, healthy food pretty much year-round, but there are other communities that struggle and often don't get much help or support from the outside. We're going to be talking about a person who has written a book to help you and I in that whole process. Allie Berlow, our guest, coming up next on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.